Welcome to Family Dynamics and Impact of Wealth. In a world where talking about the impact of money is difficult, we share stories and tips for reducing the negative impact that significant wealth can have on our emotions, relationships, and behaviors. Now here's your host, Ginny Galisonow.
Welcome, everyone. Today we have with us Charlie Birch. Charlie is an entrepreneur, a coach, a former dancer, and the co-founder of Rebel and Connect, which provides custom retreats for your remote team. Hi, Charlie. Thank you for being with us today and for your willingness to be so vulnerable as to share your story about the impact wealth has had on your life. I had known your dad for many decades and, in fact, played a small role in the creation of Birch & Davis, which subsequently grew into a very successful company. Your dad carried with him this remarkable aura where people were just drawn to him from all walks of life. Your dad was smart. He really understood people. He was one of the most generous men I know and extremely loyal to friends and family. And I'd have to say one of the more unique qualities about him was that he completely believed that he could create magic. Share with us what it was like growing up in his aura.
Well, hi, Ginny. Thanks for having me. And I'm happy to talk about that. He was the archetypal frontman. He took like the rock stardom into everything he did. I mean, and then became a rock star at the end of his life. But, you know, it was, like you said, it was a magical thing. And sometimes that was a blessing and sometimes that was a curse. He passed away recently, and one of my friends said to me, she sent flowers to my mother, and my mother sent her back a thank you note that said, "Thank you for the flowers, and just so you know, in case you were wondering, Herbie wasn't perfect." But, you know, and that was like the shadow of him. Was he was so charismatic and so full of life and so magical, and it was a lot to live up to, even for my mom, who's his partner, you know, to have to be more of the grounded partner because they were business partners. So, you know, he got kind of all the attention and all the praise. And when they look back on when they would reminisce about Birch & Davis, he always had these grand stories of traveling the world and having dinner with, you know, Saudi royalty and, you know, all these crazy stories. And she has stories of bookkeeping and paper pushing it. But we had a really wonderful time. I mean, you were a part of, we had, you know, our annual talent show where he got to celebrate his love of community and music and arts. And then later in his life with the Shack that he had his own venue all of a sudden. And that was a really cool experience for me to grow up in as well, in terms of growing up inside of a music venue is an interesting experience. And how that's informed me kind of not being starstruck. Like, I don't really get intimidated by people that are, you know, in the spotlight, because I know that my dad was one of those people, and it's just, he's just a person.
Yeah. So as a child, did you ever think you were different? And if so, how?
I mean, when we lived in Maryland before we moved to New Jersey, we had a family that, the mother of that family was our nanny. And so right away, and we're very close with that family still. But that, I guess, was my most immediate kind of social context, was our family was the employer and their family was, you know, the employed. And so that was part of my awareness, I'd say probably more implicitly at that stage of life. But I could tell, like, things revolve around my family in ways that things don't revolve around other people's families. And that shows up in conversations still. Like when I call some of my friends that have, you know, either lived with my family or worked for my family over the years, there's always more dialogue about how my mom is or how my sisters are or how my nieces and nephews are. And there's less conversation about their extended family. And I would say also, of course, you know, I remember one time when I was little being with my sister, Melanie, who you also know, and some of her friends, and I was like maybe 5 or 6. And I said, "So, you know, where'd you go to college?" And she kind of tucked me aside and said, you know, not everybody goes to college. Not everybody has the option to go to college. That's kind of a taboo question to ask in certain circles. And here I am, this 5-year-old, like, I don't know. I just think that was always the expectation. And I just thought that's what people did. They went to college. So yes, I guess I did realize that I had some privileges that other people didn't have. And Melanie was really good about making that explicit when it got lost in the shuffle. And I'm really grateful for that perspective as well. And yeah.
So was the "Are you rich?" question ever posed to you? And how did you respond to that?
You know, I don't know if it was explicitly posed to me necessarily as much as assumed and told to me by my peers. You know, you can afford to buy Domino's for everybody, or you can afford to pay for this dinner on your credit card. And my mom kind of armed me with the response of, when people do that, just tell them, like, you're not rich, your parents are rich, which in that stage of life was mildly helpful and had some interesting ripple out effect as I got older and got to a stage of my life where I was expected to maintain my financial status of my own, you know, worth or my own earning potential. And realizing, like, in my mind, like somewhere deep in my subconscious of my mind, I had this affirmation of, like, I'm not rich, my parents are. I'm not rich, my parents are. And how that potentially limited my ability to imagine myself as able to create that same level of wealth in my adult life.
So when you grew up in this small resort town, I mean, your parents, I think, were probably one of the richest families there. What was it like, especially growing up in this small resort town that was part of a rural community?
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely an interesting, I mean, we moved here around the time my mom retired, which was early in her life because of her ability to do so. And my dad, when he was still working, was either not here because he was traveling, or he was, you know, in his office working for himself in his office in that kind of a self-contained way. Whereas most of the people I knew in this area, if they had money, it was maybe not as substantial as ours. We were never like, well, my dad was kind of a flashy guy, but my mom is the opposite of that. So they mildly balanced each other out that way. But, you know, if you look around this community, the people with money are people that are, you know, doctors and lawyers and accountants that are very, you know, easy to understand jobs that are dependent on the community. And so for our family, our wealth did not come from interacting with the community, and a lot of the work for it happened remotely, which is an interesting through line to, like, the work I do now. I didn't even, like, realize as I was pursuing a career path that allowed me the freedom to work remotely and for myself. It took me a couple years into that to realize that the way I grew up had influenced that so much. But it was definitely an interesting experience because here in this area, I mean, Atlantic City is probably the biggest source of jobs, and that would revolve entirely around the casino life, which has very long, late hours. It's a very tip-oriented culture. So I had a stay-at-home mom who worked, and I had a traveling dad who worked. But a lot of my friends had, you know, parents who gave them a lot more freedom because they didn't have the ability to supervise them as much. So it was an interesting dichotomy of, like, I have potentially more freedom with my financial resources. I also have a lot more supervision than some of my friends. And so sometimes it felt like I'd rather just not have a curfew, or the way that it played out, you know, is it's definitely something I've spent a lot of time thinking about in terms of growing up, where I had more money than other people in terms of, do I get to do what I want to do? Is it okay to have this money? Is it okay to talk about having this money? Do I even have it? Is it mine? It's not mine, right? So, and my mom was always more of the modest one. My dad wanted to, you know, kind of show it off a little bit and draw people in. It was never a better than anybody else thing, but we definitely attracted some takers, and I've definitely have some sore spots in my life around feeling that I was taken advantage of for the resources and that people were friends with me because I could afford them things that they couldn't afford without my friendship, but that the exchange wasn't necessarily mutual. And then in the same regard, there was a lot of times that I learned the hard way that just because I can give doesn't mean that somebody else is ready to receive. And that sometimes when it's not a mutual exchange of giving and taking, and it's just kind of going in one direction, how that can kind of blow up in your face as well. And people can start to be resentful of your ability to give to them and their inability to give back in the same regard.
Interesting. Very, very interesting, that dynamic. So I'm going to now move to a different part of your life. There is a term known as sudden wealth. Traditionally, most people think that the winners of lotteries are the beneficiaries and victims of sudden wealth. More often than not, however, sudden wealth happens not from winning the lottery, but as a result of receiving a significant inheritance, a lawsuit, pension payout, or in the case of your mom and dad, the sale of a very successful business. For many sudden wealthers, spending suddenly has no limits, and before you know it, the windfall is gone, and often there's no cushion to offset unexpected catastrophes. I suspect that your dad's generosity and love for his family and friends contributed to this sudden wealth syndrome. Talk with us about what it was like for your dad and his children after the sale of his company and maybe after the catastrophe, so we can sort of see the difference of what his life was like after the sale of the company and then later.
Sure. So after the sale of the company, this company sold when I was in eighth grade, I believe. And after that, it was one really nice for me because he was around all the time, which was new. We actually used to have a globe that we kept in our house. And every time he would leave for a business trip, we would put a pin where he was going and eventually there was just pins everywhere. There's more pins than not. Because you couldn't keep track of where he was going to be. And he was always on the road. And, there's all kinds of factors that played into that. But all of a sudden he was around and he was driving me to school every day and he was picking me up from school every day. And that was a really special thing that I got to my little brother. That was more his reality, that my dad was around all the time. So he didn't necessarily feel that contrast, I don't think. And then my older siblings, he was divorced from their mother, so they were older and they didn't have him around in a different way, and they didn't live in the same state as us anymore when the company sold. So I think in terms of my personal experience of what was the major difference was really about his availability to me. And that really fueled our special bond. And when I went to graduate from high school and then I graduated from college and I wanted to follow in his footsteps and travel around the world, and all of a sudden he was like, well, don't go so far away. I was like, well, Dad, you wouldn't have been able to do any of this stuff if you just stayed in Ocean City. Where do you think I got this inspiration to travel, this travel bug? I didn't just make it up. I learned growing up that people who are successful are not always available. And if I'm available, then maybe I don't get it to be as successful, which is a whole other can of worms. But in terms of the money, we went from, I don't know if it was a huge drastic change because they were both advised, both my parents were advised by their financial planners to not do anything drastically different. Yes, my dad would have not probably rented a jet and flown the whole family except for me because I couldn't make it. And I'm still a little bit bitter about that, but he rented a private jet and flew the majority of the nuclear family to the Keys for a vacation. That wouldn't have happened before the sale of the company. And, he retired and started a restaurant. And with that restaurant came a music production company and a TV show and really amazing. This is, the venue I had mentioned earlier in the interview. And he was able to move my brother to New Jersey and get him set up as a co-owner of the venue and bring his son, who he, didn't get to see that often, closer into his circle. And then, like you said, from one generous, for lack of a better word, one generous gift, one generous bailout after another, eventually it just wasn't coming in as quickly as it was going out. And I think we talked about at an earlier point, a lot of his spending habits were actually informed by expense accounts. And so I think he kind of treated his portfolio like a expense account, but it wasn't being refurbished. It wasn't, you know, the amount, the type of work he was doing at that time wasn't generating as much revenue as his expenses were costing him. And, you know, he had a band and the band got paid, whether or not it was a paid gig. And so like at his own venue, that was just a cost of doing business, was to pay the band and to pay all the other bands. And it's a seasonal area. So 3 months out of the year, we're making money and the rest of the time we're bleeding money. And so that was, he never really had to pay attention to what he was spending because he was making money at the same time. But and then he had this huge influx. Like you said, he's like, okay, now I have all this money. I have more cash flow than I've ever had in my life. But his earning potential was not as high. And it got all teeter-tottery, and eventually, you know, house of cards, it all kind of fell down.
You're listening to Family Dynamics and Impact of Wealth. For more information, visit our website, dynamicsoffamilywealth.com. And now back to the show.
So I remember you saying something to the effect that your dad had always been so lavish with his gifts for when he was traveling. And so you had become accustomed to essentially having your needs financially met when you need them, if you needed to move or you needed to, and all these gifts. And then all of a sudden that changed. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. I mean, I was always encouraged to work hard, but I was not always encouraged to work hard for money. So like, for example, I was a dancer, like you mentioned, and dance is a pretty expensive habit, especially if you're like on a traveling competition team like I was. You know, there's costumes, there's competition fees, there's studio fees, there's travel expenses, all these things. And a lot of the, and that kind of goes back to your question of like, did I know I was different? Like everyone else on my team is doing fundraising, selling candy and wallpaper and whatever the thing was that year. And my mom was always just like, I don't want this crap in my house. And you have better things to do with your time, like your homework. And she would just write me a check. And I never had to do the fundraising. So I never got that skill of asking people for money. And I never had to associate time and money before. And then all of a sudden, you know, 2010, I was 29 years old. The memo update from the family was, we can't do this anymore. You want to ski? Buy your own pass. You want to travel? Buy your own airplane tickets. You have an emergency? You better have savings because we can't do it. And it's worth noting, you know, like at that point, the size of the family grew exponentially as the size of the bank diminished. So we went from having, you know, for all intents and purposes, six children that were getting financial support to six children, many of them married, many of them with two or three children of their own. And so like a family vacation to go to Vail, instead of it being six people, all of a sudden it was like 20 people. You know, so the cost of the family kept expanding and the resources of the family weren't even sustaining themselves. Mm-hmm. And so I 29 years old, I have never had to work for money. I worked because it was the socially acceptable thing to do. And because sitting on my couch watching TV, eating bonbons is like not my style, you know, but I had to earn. And I never had to do that before. And I didn't have the negotiation skills to negotiate fair pay. I didn't have the interview skills to get the competitive jobs. You know, I didn't have the understanding of like, how much do I have to save? And when do I save it? So I actually implemented for myself once I stopped treading water, I immediately was like, okay, I'm going to save 10% of everything I earn. And I actually remember having a really interesting conversation with my mother where I was like, well, I owe this person money for this thing and I owe that person money for that thing and I can't afford food. Like, I can't afford to buy food. And she was like, Charlie, you have to pay yourself first. And I was like, well, but I owe this money. And like, I also didn't have any credit, so I couldn't get a credit card. And I didn't have bad credit, but I didn't have any credit because my mom and dad paid for my college. They paid for my car. I paid my bills on time, so I didn't have bad credit, but like, I didn't have any credit record. I didn't have a regular employment history because I was a career student because I could, because I didn't have to work. And my mom was actually more inclined to help me financially if I was in school. Like, I didn't have student loans, you know? So it was just a total shock to my system, and one I'm grateful for, actually.
Lessons have a funny way of taking us through immense shock and trauma. And then if you are paying attention at the end of the day, you find out, wow, that was a good lesson for me to learn.
Absolutely.
Maybe could have learned it a little differently, but would it have had the same impact? Don't know.
No, probably not.
Yeah. You had also mentioned something about, you know, the fact that you, growing up in a resort town, that you were taught to fit in or to play down, if you will, and that you feel like that affected you somehow as a woman.
Yeah, I mean, I think absolutely with my dad in his part of his life when he was making the most money, he was a bigwig in his circles, you know, but they were healthcare management circles. They weren't particularly sexy, flashy circles, you know, and they were just disparate, you know, they were all over the place. So like, his network knew him and he had a powerful network. But when we moved, you know, if you were walking down the street in Colombia where we lived when he was in that stage of his life, you weren't going to have people coming up to you going, oh my God, Herb. That like wouldn't have happened. But when we moved here and he opened the restaurant and he has this TV show and he's on stage 7 nights a week and he's playing local block parties and he looks like Jerry Garcia and Jerry Garcia just died, you know, he would drive me to school and we would stop at the Wawa, which if you're familiar with New Jersey and Pennsylvania is the best convenience store in the world, the best little convenience. So every morning I would stop and I'd get a bagel
and coffee.
And I would not let him come into the Wawa with me. Because if he came in, we would be in there for like 45 minutes to an hour and a half, like talking to people who were his fans. So I would just kind of, you know, slip into the Wawa, grab a bagel and slip out. Otherwise, I'm going to be late for school. When I was in school, all of our school dances, all of our school showcases, they were all hosted at the restaurant. So there was this downplaying of, because, you know, I'm also in that stage. I love my dad. We're very close. But there was also that like, oh, dad. Oh, like kind of like you're embarrassed by your parents. And I know he's just a human. And he's like this, he's got this different voice that he does when he's on stage. And he's got this different, these mannerisms and this character that he puts on. And to me and my sister, especially with Melanie, she's just like, oh, like he told us, I'm going to write this song called Jersey Tomatoes, Vidalia Onions, and White Corn. And we were both like, that's the stupidest idea we've ever heard. Please don't get up on stage and sing that. This is stupid. Don't do that. And people loved it. They loved it. It was like an anthem for the whole area. So there was always a kind of attempt to kind of glide below the radar, if you will, in terms of being the person that people, oh, you're Bubba's daughter. And he used to try to call me Bubette and all this stuff. And I was like, please don't call me that. Please don't call me Bubette. Like, no. So there was that piece of it, you know, of I didn't want to be a star. I didn't have that. I do want to be respected in my field, absolutely, but I don't want to be like a blazing star. But then there's the piece of, you know, kind of downplaying my skills, downplaying my resources. And that didn't really come, I didn't really become aware of that until, I don't know, maybe 4 or 5 years ago. I went to this seminar in California that was, you know, a business growth seminar specifically for solo coaches and mastering your elevator speech and, you know, increasing your sales with clever conversation and blah, blah, blah. And they talk a lot about positioning, packaging and positioning, how to position yourself as an expert, how to position yourself as an authority, and how to make yourself look like you were the best. And everybody should want to work with you, and everybody should want to talk to you. And I realized that I had not only not been positioning myself as an authority, as an expert, but I have this tendency to down position myself and mute myself and put myself in a position of more of like a wallflower, because a lot of the attention I got from the natural positioning I had was mildly unwelcome. Like, it got in my way. Like, I don't want to talk about how I'm Bubba's daughter all the time. I also, like, because the positioning that I had was proximity to somebody else, I just wanted to differentiate myself by not being positioned.
Right. Yeah, it's kind of interesting because on one hand, your dad was playing it big and visibly big. And on the other hand, you were encouraged to fit in and you were in his shadow. So in some ways, it's how do you step up and become your own when it's always this aura, the universe, if you will, kind of assumes that you want to be not only part of, but maybe like, similar or like, yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, it's interesting because like I didn't fit in, you know? Like I didn't start school here. I moved in. I don't play sports. I'm like this weird artsy kid, you know? I also had my mom, because of the age cutoff when we moved here, I did the fourth grade twice. So I did fourth grade in Maryland, and then when we moved here, I did it again because she didn't want me to be with a group of people that were so much older than me because of the cutoff. So my first year in school, I'm sitting in the corner in the back of the classroom doing a completely different curriculum than everybody else. Like, so I didn't fit in, and I didn't want to be the center of attention for that reason, and I'm sure that played into it too. And yeah, it's a very interesting, weird little place. And it's not super friendly to outsiders, but my dad wasn't an outsider. He grew up here in the summers, and he was that kid in the summer that like somehow he made people forget he was what we call a shoobie,
right?
Which is a tourist, you know, that does, he's not from here. And somehow he managed to not be, you know, labeled that way. And I think a lot of that is just because he decided he had that ability. He was just going to decide how you were going to see him. You know, we kind of jokingly say like he was a narcissist, and he was, and we got lucky that he was a narcissist who valued family. Like a big part of his identity was being a great father and being a great provider. And so, you know, the narcissism didn't have a negative effect like it can.
Yeah, I think that his loyalty to family and friends and that generous spirit was such a wonderful balance to that narcissism.
Absolutely.
So I like to leave our listeners with a small or big action step that they can take away and implement on their own. Is there a last word of wisdom you'd like to share with us?
Yeah, you know, I actually had a conversation with my mom a couple years ago at Christmas. She just small talk. She just throw in these big questions. She's like, if there was one thing that me and your dad could have done differently, I have my answer. But just if there was one thing we could have done differently in raising you, like, what would you say that thing would have been? And I said, I wish you would have made me work. I didn't need to work to get food. I didn't need to work to buy that pair of UGG boots. I didn't need to work to pay for dance. I needed to work to learn how to work for money, to understand the relationship between effort and earning, and to get comfortable when I didn't need the money, asking for what I felt like I deserved, and practice asking for what I think I did. I mean, I'm 33 years old. I'm a freelancer, and every time I have a conversation with a potential client, I mean, I have to pump myself up so bad. And I almost always undersell myself all the time. And then I'm mad and I'm frustrated about it. Make your children work. If you're a child and you're listening to this and your parents don't make you work, get a job. Even if it's just like 5 hours a week, get used to earning money from your effort, because it's a completely different thing than having money given to you. Like, to say to your parent, hey, can I have like $1,000 to go, and, or, you know, I need help paying a bill. Asking for money to be given to you without effort is a different thing than having money given to you because you earned it. And it's such an important skill. Like, I have to still in my mind, like, I'm not asking for a handout. And I was a rich kid and I was asking for handouts, and not from, you know, the local church or some kind of community program. I was asking for handouts from my parents. I was like, will you please fund my extravagant lifestyle? And then there was always this underlying feeling of guilt and shame around it, because I knew I didn't deserve it, but I was asking for it, and I could get away with asking for it. And there's like this slight little bit of manipulation that would happen. And that's the way I learned how to make money, was to ask for it from people who I knew were going to give it to me. And a lot of the times, especially as a woman, the people who are going to give you money when you don't deserve it are not the kind of people you want to be around.
Wow, powerful last words. Really powerful. Thank you so much, Charlie, for your wonderful story, which I know so many of our listeners from several different age brackets will be able to relate to.
And thank you.
Yes, it was great to have you on the call. And for all of our listeners, I look forward to being with you again during our next podcast.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Family Dynamics and Impact of Wealth. For more information on this podcast, or guidance for having more meaningful conversations around inherited or sudden wealth, please visit our website at dynamicsoffamilywealth.com.